There was a story that was told of an old professor who was speaking at various different universities and schools. He was brilliant, this professor. He would answer questions. He would just know exactly what he was talking about. And his presentation was so enlightening and insightful that he was invited to tour all over the country, all over the place. And at one particular lecture, it was absolutely brilliant. People were amazed at his clarity and his insight. And he was driving back from this lecture, and his driver was driving him as he always did. And the driver would come in and listen to the lectures as he did them. And he would always do the same lecture because this was the one which people wanted. And the driver said to him, "How are you feeling?" And the professor said, "Well, I'm a little bit tired this evening. I'm a little bit tired." And so the driver said, "Well, I have an idea. I've heard you give your lecture so many times. I think that I could give that speech for you and you could just sit and listen and it would give you a break. What do you think?" And the old professor chuckled and said, "Okay, you're on." And so they swapped clothes, and the professor sat as the driver in the front row, and the driver dressed as a professor and did the lecture, and he did it word for word the same. And the audience hung on his every word. They knew sort of exactly the same point, that there was a gasp as the insight flowed from the professor. The same thing happened with the driver as he presented the same ideas. And at the end of the lecture, he did very, very well, but the only difference was that he spoke faster than the professor. And so, unfortunately, he finished the lecture early, and he and the host stood up and said, "Well, would anybody like to ask a question? Because we now have some time." And the driver thought, "Oh dear." So the first person asked a question, and the question was as insightful and as demanding as the lecture had been from somebody in the audience, somebody they didn't know. And the driver said, or the driver sort of dressed as the professor said, "Do you know what? That question is so simple, so easy, so facetious, that I bet even my driver could answer it." Maybe when it comes to questions of, does science make faith in God irrational, we feel like we're just trotting out answers sometimes without actually knowing what's behind them. Some of what I'm about to teach you and take you through might be stretching, but I hope that you'll stay with me and that you'll believe that you can get more of this than you might anticipate. So, does science make faith in God irrational? And I'm not just going to give you pat answers. I'm going to hopefully take you into some of the theory and some of the ideas here and help you to see some of what's what. And the first thing I want to say is this. I came to university initially to do computer science, robotics, cybernetics, and philosophy. I love science. I think science is amazing. I'm interested in science. I watch documentaries on science. I have a number of scientists in the family, a number of medics in the family. I think science helps people. I think it often has an ethical, moral value through alleviating, in its best example, suffering and pain. I think that science is interesting. I think that it enhances life. It's wonderful. I think that it enriches life. I think it has an elegance to it, and it's sometimes in its theories and in its reductions. And that elegance is to me beautiful. I get that. I love that. And I think that's really important. I also find science humbling. I find its creativity inspiring, the way that we have to think about how we're going to create an experiment to test that particular idea. And I think that it's an amazing thing that shows you not only how big the world out there is, but how big the world down here is when we go into the subatomic level. I think science is the most amazing thing. I think science is worth investing in. I think if you've been invested in science, then you've done a good thing. I think that if you're encouraging others to invest in science, if you're training people in science, or if you have kids or relatives who are thinking about involving themselves in science, I think that's worth praising. I think science is worth valuing. And that's the first thing that I want to say in answer or in discussion of this. Science is worth investing in, and it's a good thing. Now, Peter Atkins is a guy who wrote a lot of the textbooks on biochemistry at Oxford. He he's an atheist. And this title, science versus Christianity, science versus faith, does science make faith in God irrational, suggests that there's a conflict between science and Christianity. Is there a conflict? Well, some, like Peter Atkins, the Oxford chemist, would say that science one day will explain everything, absolutely everything that is real. He says there's no reason to suppose that science can't deal with every aspect of existence. Philosophers, I am afraid, have contributed to the understanding of the universe little more than poets. I long for immortality, but I know that my only hope of achieving it is through science and medicine, not through sentiment and its subsets, art and theology. So he doesn't have a very high view of poets, among others. So he's on one side of the fence. Science will explain everything. Science is all you need. Anything that matters, you access it through science. It's all that matters in terms of understanding knowledge. And then there's Richard Dawkins' hero, Peter Medawar, Nobel Prize winning biologist who's passed away now. And he took a different view to Peter Atkins. He says that there is indeed a limit on science is made very likely by the existence of questions that science cannot answer, and that no advance of science would empower it to answer. And these are the questions that science, that children ask, the ultimate questions of Karl Popper. I have in mind such questions like, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? And it's not to science, but therefore to metaphysics, to the questions beyond physics that philosophers use. Imaginative literature, so fiction and non-fiction, and to religion that we must turn for answers to questions having to do with these first and last, these bigger questions, these first and last things. He takes a different perspective. Now, I'm no longer involved in science personally, but I come to this as a philosopher, and I think that gives me some degree of neutrality, because as a philosopher, I'm trained to look at the ideas underneath what people are doing and to understand how their worldview and the ideas that they hold shape what they do. And so I'm trying to look at it from both perspectives. One perspective is Peter Atkins, and the other perspective is Medawar. And both of them are different ends of the extreme, or different ends of the spectrum. I wonder how we would answer these sorts of questions. I wonder how we would figure out. Maybe you'd think of examples of things that science can't explain or that science can't access. You could do that, I think. I think you could point to things that are real, that science can't give you, can't deliver that knowledge to you, but you still know they're real. Maybe the risk of being a little bit too philosophical, there is a body in this room sitting in a chair listening to a talk by a guy who's saying an odd philosophical thing now. And there's a body in this room, and you know which of those bodies is yours. You know which of the bodies in this room is yours right now. You know that it's not another body. You know the body that you're sitting in is your body. Somehow you know that weird philosophical fact. It's slightly profound, I know, but you know which body in this room is yours. You know that body. Now, how do you know that? Through science? No, you kind of have a direct knowledge of it. You know things through memory as well. You know things through relationship. We could go that way in solving and aren't trying to answer some of these questions. But let me try to bring it to a really practical level. Really practical level. How would you measure the value of a human life? How would you measure the value of a human life? Two very different perspectives, Peter Atkins, Peter Medawar. But let's start with this question. How would you measure the value of a human life? Surely it's an important question for bioethics, for society, for human rights. But how would you measure the worth of a human life? What axes would you use? What measurements would you use? Now, a chemist might try to say, well, let's answer this question in terms of the elements that make up that life, that person or you. Perhaps you would be more valuable if you had gold teeth. And they could test that, you know, take your teeth out and sort of run them through a machine, give them back to you. You might not want them after that. But a physiologist might try to measure the size of your muscles or the size of your brain. A psychologist might say, well, Let's try and measure how smart you are, how fast your EQ, your IQ, your, I don't know, something Q is, how fast your particular type of intelligence is, how quickly you can figure things out in different situations. Are you a lateral thinker? Are you more abstracted? A psychologist might approach things like that. An anthropologist might say, well, I'm going to look around at society with the other sociologists. I'm going to look around at society. I'm going to look at how other people perceive you, how other people value you. And I'm going to look at your value as a sort of construct of how they view you, how you're perceiving yourself in society. And it's going to be somewhere in the middle of that that I'll understand what your value is, what a human life is. Now, an economist might say, somebody who looks at the economy or economic theory, they might say, well, I'm trying to work out how much value you create, how much productivity you generate, how much wealth you generate or income you generate in your life. And that might be my way of sort of measuring the value of that life. So you have all these different lenses. And I think all of us can see quite quickly that there's an impulse in us that says, actually, no, we might have all of that information, but there's something more. There's something more to us than just all of those different axes. There's something that they don't capture about what it is to be me and what it is to be you. And maybe we would say these are the wrong axes, or they are part of the picture, but they're not the whole picture. We need something to bring them together or something to sort of ground them in, perhaps. And I think this instinct that we have, that there's something more than those descriptions, I think that's right. I think that's correct. That what we are is more than chemicals, that what we are is more than what society thinks of us, that what we are is more than what society happens to value at this point in history. I think that's an instinct that we share, and I think that's right that we share that. Science derives its power from limiting itself. That's how it works. Science derives its power from limitations, and it focuses with really powerful intensity on a very limited area, on a limited picture and question. Remove those other variables, remove those other elements, remove those other things that might be affecting things. Let's just have this control experiment and work out what this one thing is happening. Let's just understand this narrow area. It focuses on particular types of questions and particular types of subject matter that are themselves, that subject matter, those questions are open to a scientific investigation. Science can't study things that are not open to that type of limiting investigation. Now, it may be that things are not open to that type of investigation. And it may be that those things that are not open to that type of scientific investigation, that they may still be able to be investigated. We may just need to use different routes. Science focuses on particular types of questions, typically questions or subject matter that's repeatable. That's the way science works. It's limiting, and then it focuses on subject matter that you can repeat over and over and over again, and then you can test it in different environments. That's how science functions. Now, you might ask, you know, where else could we look to look at subject matter that isn't repeatable, that can't be focused and narrowed in that way? Well, you could look to, as Peter Medawar says, other fields, philosophy, to movies, to music, to religion, to history, to theology, to personal experience, to literature, to stories, or even just your everyday experience of life. And perhaps it's also here that we need to look to for answers to the questions that Peter Medawar poses. Now, the philosopher Alvin Plantinga uses a really helpful story to explain the point that I'm trying to make here. Now, imagine a bit later this evening, you are walking down a dark alley and feeling safe because you know that, you know, friends are a moment or two behind you or something. You see somebody, stumbling around under a lamppost, looking what would seem like they're searching for something under the light of a lamppost. And so you walk over to them and you say, oh, are you okay? Can I help you? They say, actually, I've lost my keys. I'm looking for them. Will you help me? And you say, sure, no problem. I'll help you. Been to seminars this morning about helping people and building conversations on, you know, what I need to do in this situation. I need to serve you. So you say, oh, I'm sure you'd help them anyway. So you start looking around on the ground, and the pool of light isn't terribly big around the lamppost, and so it doesn't take you very long to establish, you know, the keys aren't there under the lamppost. So you say to the person, okay, where did you last have them? Where did you lose them? And the person said, oh, I don't know where I lost them. It's just here is where the light is brightest. I don't know where I lost them. Just here is where the light is brightest. Now, to think that science is the only way of reaching the truth, the only way of reaching answers, is a bit like saying you can only find your keys under the lamppost. Peter Atkins would say, not just that science shines a very bright light, but that there are definitely no keys anywhere else. But what do you think? What do you make of that? What's your response to that? Do you think some questions are genuinely outside of science? Do you think some questions lie outside of that repeatable, narrowed, scientific way of studying the world? Science is very, very powerful because it shines that very bright light on things. But maybe it's also worth saying that in this example of the lamppost and looking for the keys, can you imagine? I mean, imagine if you stepped on the corner on the edge of the pool of light around the lamppost. What would happen? You're blinded by the lamppost standing under it. But what happens if you step out from under a blinding light into sort of... Your eyes start to adjust, don't they? And what looked to you as complete darkness when you're in the pool of light, now you begin to see shapes. And actually, you let your eyes adjust for a few minutes, you can see almost perfectly because of the reflected light, because of the other light from other sources that's around there. And maybe then you can see and find the keys. To say that some questions lie outside of that very bright light under the lamppost or that very bright light of scientific investigation doesn't mean that those shadow questions, the questions that lie in shadow at the moment, aren't capable of being true or false, aren't capable of being really clear. In fact, I think you can know some of those things even more clearly than you can know the scientific method. For example, that it is wrong to torture innocent babies for fun. That is absolutely wrong, except that isn't a question that you could develop through a repeatable experiment. That's something that's in the shadows. And you know that very, I think we know that very, very clearly. It doesn't mean that these non-scientific shadowy questions are not capable of being true or false or right and wrong. It's just simply that they may not be able to be investigated in the same sort of way. And as amazing as science is, questions of value, questions of meaning, questions of big picture purpose are just not accessible through that type of way of investigating things. In fact, I think all of us are building a tapestry, are building a way of looking at the world that has different interlacing, interrelating, interconnecting threads. I think every single person in this room is a philosopher to some degree, and you're forming and you have formed a view of the world. It might be that view of the world is formed around certain ideas, certain experiences. Like Joe was saying, you know, there are things that happen to us that are deep down. We may ask these questions, but actually our worldview and our perspective is being formed by a picture we found in our dad's wallet. That's what's actually the core idea, the core principle underlying my commitment or my view of reality. And some of our worldviews, some of our philosophies, some of our tapestries are chaotic, and you can't see a picture emerging in the threads because we've just sort of bunged all these threads in there together and they don't really link up. But there's still a desire in us, I think, there's a need for coherence. We want coherence, and we want to see a picture that's interlocking. We want to see a picture that's emerging on the tapestry where my ideas about the world and my ideas about science and your ideas about the world and your experiences match and meet up together. So we're not in a kind of chaos where we have to believe these totally mutually contradictory things. I teach some courses in logic and critical thinking, sort of how we think carefully and clearly. And I sometimes like to call it the science of common sense. And I'm going to now give you three mistakes in thinking that I think we often make when it comes to the science and faith question. So first of all, the first one I want to talk about is science or stupid. And then I'm going to talk about zombies You didn't expect that. Third one I'm going to talk about is the idea of the mechanism and whether it exhausts meaning. So those are your three headings, I guess. Science or stupid, zombies, and mechanism and meaning. And I'm going to then suggest a strategy for you for taking your own discussions and your own investigations into these questions further. Okay, so first of all, science or stupid? Richard Dawkins says this. He says, it's time for people of intellect, one choice, using your intellect. It's time for people of intellect as opposed to people of faith, the other choice, not using intellect, just using faith, to stand up and say, enough. I think this is exactly what we need to avoid saying. Either science, intellect, or faith, stupid. I think it's a mistake to say you have to choose between faith and stupid or science and thinking. It's a mistake because it's a false choice. It's where you're offered just those two choices. And there is, in fact, a third choice and a fourth choice and a sixth choice. The third choice might be this. It might be that, like the historic church, you see faith as being connected to and linked to thinking. Remember we talked about the Apostle Paul and how he persuaded the Jews that Jesus was the Christ from the scriptures, so that the exercise of their minds, their rational capabilities, their thinking, their intellects, their scientific way of viewing the world, was tied up with their being convinced that Jesus was the Christ, that Jesus was the one. In the same sort of way, the Gentiles were being persuaded, their rationality was being engaged with. And so out of that came this this faith, which was tied up with and bound up with thinking. In fact, the words that the New Testament uses to talk about faith mean to be persuaded intellectually, thoughtfully, that the object of your faith is real and true. It's the word pisteo, pistis. It means to be persuaded that your faith is real. That's the way the New Testament talks about faith. We may, in contemporary society, like to say, well, faith is just a leap, it's just a jump in the dark. But the New Testament doesn't talk about faith in that way. It talks about an act of faith which comes out of clear, persuaded, real, grounded, evidence-based faith. But an act of faith comes as a decision that you make in a moment that comes from that confidence of knowing that your faith is real. When Abraham went up the mountain with Isaac, he wasn't unsure of who God was. He knew who God was. And he even knew that Isaac somehow had to survive because he knew that he would be promised that he would have descendants as numerous as the stars. He knew some of what was going to happen because he'd already got this relationship with God. In fact, wherever Abraham went, he would build altars to God, demonstrating that personal living relationship with God. It was never from a vacuum. So I want to try to talk about how this false choice isn't a good way of approaching things. Let me try to illustrate where this third way, this third choice of intellect and faith come together. Now imagine you're going to make the decision to get married. Imagine you're thinking about that decision. Some of you have already thought about that decision. How do you go about picking the right person? How do you go about choosing making that decision? Now there are clearly some pretty bonkers ways of making this decision. Imagine that you were just to walk out of here, and then the first person that you saw, you were going to ask them to marry you. That would be pretty nuts, wouldn't it? But imagine that person said yes. That would be even more horrifying, perhaps. But how do we go about that in a rational way? You can't use science, can you? You can't use a repeatable experiment to try to test whether or not that's the right person. That might be a bit weird. Now, you might do a survey and show some sort of psychological, emotional compatibility, and that can be helpful, but it can't really tell you whether or not that we're the right person to marry. But I think we tend towards doing this still in a careful, thoughtful, evidence-based way, hopefully. Now, what you do is you get to know the person. You go on dates. You have courtship. You see if you're compatible. You go on dates. I remember one of my first dates, I took my wife to IKEA. Not such a great first date. but you took her on your motorbike, so that was okay in the end. And you really talk, you examine life, you talk about, hopefully, what you want to do with your lives, what your shared passions and interests are. And you try to examine whether you have a similar vision for life. And then you ask people that you trust who have seen you together, maybe your parents, maybe friends, and you say to them, look, you know, do you think we're a good match? Do you think we're a good fit for each other? Are we better together? Do you think are we being good to each other, do you think? Are we healthy for each other? And then you listen carefully, hopefully. That's the challenge, isn't it? You listen to what they say and you try to say, okay, how do we rebalance things or how do we rethink this? And that's how we go about doing that, in a rational way, but equally also moving towards a commitment. And maybe there's some similarity there. It's not science or stupid here in the case of choosing who you're going to marry, but it's actually, there's a reasonable, logical, rational way of doing this. I just wasn't able to have a scientific certainty before I knew that Caroline, my wife, was a good match for me, as disappointing as that was to me. Perhaps I ought to have designed a repeatable experiment and sort of made her sort of go through that. That would have been quite fun, but I'm not sure she would have wanted to marry me afterwards. Caroline and I were able to carefully and rationally consider the decision beforehand, and then we had to make a step of commitment to find out. Faith and reason, not faith or reason. Faith and reason, not faith or reason. And I think we do this all of the time. I think you do this when you are looking on eBay, when you're deciding where you're going to weigh up. Is that person, have they got a good seller rating? What's their percentage score? Does this shop seem trustworthy? Do they seem like a good brand to buy from? Is their stuff reliable? Do I have good evidence historically? Is this car a good car to get? Have people had problems with it? And you're building evidence, you're building a rational case for that commitment, but you're not doing a scientific experiment, but you're doing it in a rational kind of way. The decision you make about what you're going to do for a job, where you're going to work, what you're going to study at university. This is something that you are doing a rational investigation into, but you can't have scientific repeatable evidence for it, and you're not just making a crazy sort of leap in the dark decision. You're saying, actually, I'm building a case, I can't do it scientifically, and I'm getting to a point where I'm going to commit on the basis of the evidence. And that's what I think we do all the time. And I think that if we take on this attitude where we have to have this sort of scientific certainty, this sort of scientific skepticism, where we won't believe something until evidence is shown for it, then there's going to be a lot of evidence that we miss out on in terms of faith. There's also going to be a lot of evidence that you'll never see in life. And also, I put it to you, you're not doing that in any other area of your life. Actually, many of the major areas of your life, you're not able to have scientific certainties before you actually move forward and need to move forward in those areas. And it's interesting that those of us who are Christians would probably say that this isn't too dissimilar to the type of decision that we make when we put our trust in God. That when we open up to, when we make that commitment to a real living relationship with him, it's not something that we have scientific data that we're going to say, okay, it's just a repeatable scientific experiment that tells us that God is real. And it's not just simply a matter of faith where we just hope it's true and we leap in and we don't really know. But actually, we look at the information that's available. We look at history. We look at the arts. We look at theology. We look at philosophy. We look at different areas. And then we say, okay, this seems like it's the best decision. This seems like it's real. And then we step into that, the possibility of that relationship. And then I think we transition into a whole other thing. I think when we start to experience and we start to really know God. Okay. So that's the first thing. It's not faith or reason. It's faith and reason. First mistake to look out for. I hope you don't make it. And I hope you're able to challenge people around you not to make that mistake and to point out those examples of buying things, of choosing somebody to marry, and help you in those conversations as well. Second thing to look out for. Okay. Zombies. Okay. So after that false dilemma, science or irrationality, the second thing to look out for is what we would call the conflict myth, or the zombie myth. friend of mine called Ard Louis, who's a professor of physics, of theoretical physics at the University of Oxford, coined this idea of it being a bit like a zombie myth, because it sort of comes back again and again and again, even if it doesn't have a basis in history or in fact. The idea here is that science and faith are in some fundamental conflict, but actually that's not the case, really. The trouble is a bit like a zombie. I don't know how many of you are watching The Walking Dead or have seen a zombie epic. The problem with a zombie, for those of you who don't know, is if you knock a zombie down, zombie gets back up again and sort of comes for you. And you have to deal with a zombie in the right sort of way, apparently. Just good for us all to know these things, isn't it? Now, there's this general misunderstanding that questions like evolution, questions like miracles, questions like Adam and Eve, questions like how did the fall of mankind happen, or when did it happen, the origin of evil, questions in bioethics, the age of the universe, how old is the universe, how long has it been here for, the origin of life, how did life come about, questions of what we call intelligent design, or irreducible complexity, questions about the fossil record and where that came from and what that means, and questions about dinosaurs and multiverse theory and scientific claims. Many of these sorts of questions sort of feed into some of this. And actually, sometimes I think we find that in thinking about some of the broad brushstrokes, it helps to resolve some of these questions. Now, I'd like to try to give some specific answers to those questions, but given the variety of different opinions in the room here probably, and given my own limitations with time, I probably can't cover all of those things to everybody's satisfaction. You'll be relieved to hear. But what I want to do is to try to look sociologically. I think I could work through some of those areas and show you that there isn't conflict, and show you that there's actually complementarity, where actually things make sense if you really look into them carefully. And you're welcome to ask about those things if you'd like to later. But what I'm going to try to do to deal with the conflict I did, to deal with this zombie myth of faith being in a fundamental conflict with science, is I'm going to try to look at history and just look at scientists currently in physics department in Oxford doing science. Okay, so, and I hope you'll find that a helpful way to approach it. So here's historically what's happened. Even though it's very common now in our society, in our culture, to see science and faith in conflict, it's actually quite a recent thing to see them in conflict. Science and faith in the God of the Bible have not always been perceived as enemies. From the 1500s to the 1850s or so, there was no real mention of conflict in the literature. And then from the 1850s onwards, there started to be the mention of conflict between the church and between scientists. And what had been happening was not a discovery of some fundamental conflict in terms of what scientists had shown, but actually it was to do with something else. In late Victorian England, sort of 1700s, the clergyman and sort of scientist Gilbert White began doing science. And at the same time, lots of untrained amateur gentlemen scientists also started to do science. And some of them were doing things, for example, that would sort of, you know, sell their crazy hair serum. And they would have some sort of crazy experiment which purported to offer, you know, that this thing was able to do it. And so science began to be seen as amateur, as unprofessional, as just something that people used to sell stuff. It became a bit of a sales spiel. But that actually was very troubling, as you can imagine, to professional, serious scientists who thought that they really needed to do serious science, as we can imagine. And this led to an emergence of a movement called the professionalization of science movement. And that movement was very important. And this movement said only trained, professional, serious scientists are able to do research and can claim to be scientists. And members of this movement wanted science to become completely independent from any other control. Now, much of education historically had come from the church. And so at that point, they started to argue that any other control over science and over scientists should be severed. So they needed to be completely independent in order to defend the professionalization of science, in order to defend the reputation of science and to escape any external controls. And this led to a process called breaking free. And the professional scientists began arguing that the church and science were in warfare or in conflict. And that's That's what began to happen. So there was then hostility between scientists and between the church. But this conflict view carried on into the 21st century. And when a media story comes up, like, you know, questions about evolution, questions about dinosaurs, questions about bioethics, questions about the origin of the universe, that almost kind of lands, oddly enough, into this historical perceived conflict. But this original conflict came from this historical situation. So these conflicts were more to do with institutional politics. They were more to do with power struggles, personal agendas, and personality issues, rather than the discovery of any fundamental incompatibility between science and Christian faith or faith. And so the point is this. Christianity and science were in conflict, but that doesn't... So scientists and the church were in conflict, but that doesn't mean that science and Christianity was in conflict. So you had scientists in conflict with the church, but there was some institutional, structural reasons to do with that, which I think I've explained. So that's the historical situation. And then Ard says this, this professor at Oxford, who's leading this interdisciplinary thinking and research group, looking at problems on the border between biology and physics and chemistry. He says this, I'm often asked how you can be a scientist and a Christian. Aren't those things like being a vegetarian butcher or a pacifistic soldier? Isn't it just a contradiction in terms to be a scientist, a rational person, and a religious person? There's lots of ways of answering that, but one of the ways of looking at it is to look at it sociologically, and so to look at people who are actually doing science in top universities. So in Oxford University in the physics department, I have quite a few colleagues, maybe 15 or 20 or so, who are active members of churches that I know of. And we actually meet regularly to talk about science and faith. And in fact, none of us think that our science detracts from our faith. We tend to think that it enhances it. Historian of science Peter Harrison says this, those who argue for an incompatibility of science and religion will draw no comfort from history. The myth of a perennial conflict between science and religion is one to which no historian of science would sign up to, would subscribe to. He wrote a book called Galileo Goes to Jail, very interesting book that you might find interesting. But I think we've seen here that actually this conflict idea isn't from a fundamental conflict, at least historically, between Christianity and science. In fact, science has deep Christian roots. If you think about it, the idea of uniformity isn't something that you necessarily expect. If you look at the world, you tend to think, well, you know, different things happen in different places. But Christian faith supplied early scientists with a theological reflection, with an idea. And the idea was that was because God was consistent, because God's nature was consistent and continuous, therefore we may be able to see regularities, uniformities, standards that were true in all places in the world. And so if you did an experiment here in Chichester in the school, you could do the same experiment under the same conditions in Oxford and you would find exactly the same result. And that's because of uniformity, because you expect the same thing, and because the natural world behaves in uniform ways. But if you look at the natural world, generally, the impression people got from looking at the natural world was not that it was uniform, but it was capricious. It did sort of seemingly things unpredictably. And Christian faith furnished early scientists with an understanding of uniformity, an idea that things would be the same in different places. And for most of history, people didn't think in terms of uniformity. And that seemed to be a very irrational thing to think of. But actually, if there's a God who created the world and who sustains the world, in other words, if what we're studying when we study the regular ways that the world works, the way that God works in the world, we may expect there to be a regularity, a continuity, a similarity, because God is faithful. And therefore, we expect that regularity and that uniformity in the world, you see? And so they believe, these early scientists believe that actually God created an ordered world that was capable of investigation. And they thought God had created them with minds, the capacity of making sense of God's world. I can't remember who it was. I don't know, I think it may have been, I can't remember who exactly it was. But somebody said that one of the most surprising things about the world is that we can make sense of it, that it is intelligible. that there are, we have these abilities to describe things just with the particular capabilities of our minds, the way our minds work. I don't know if you've seen the film The Martian, where Matt Damon plays an astronaut who's stuck on Mars. I won't spoil the ending, but it all comes down to a complex mathematical calculation. It's very interesting that human beings have minds that are able to do this extraordinary abstract mathematics. And yet that's exactly the skill that's now needed when we're doing advanced science. Doesn't matter if you're doing it in biology or physics. It's there, this underlying need to describe things with this very powerful, complex mathematics. Now, God's given humans the capacity of making sense of the world, and these early scientists saw worship as including their work, including their science. And so that's part of why they were doing it. And they believed that they had a responsibility in the world to be caretakers, to steward the world. And so Christian faith, in fact, fueled the modern scientific revolution. The new science was catalyzed by those who believed in God. They were inspired by the beauty of the natural world. And it was these theological ideas, often these underlying ideas about God and his nature, that drove their science. Very, very interesting. This is the way they came into science, and often this is the way that many of them were influenced by it. And you see that actually some of the founders of the Royal Society were much more religious than the average person of the time. They were driven by their religious beliefs. And many scientists, past and present, have made significant contributions to their fields, but they don't believe that science is in conflict with faith or with Christianity. Rather, they think that science and their faith inspire and enhance one another. They're motivated by order in nature, by the great beauty of nature, and belief that they might discover things in creation that pointed towards the creator that they worshipped and that they knew. Okay, so we've seen from this historical discussion that the zombie thing doesn't really work, that they're not really in conflict. They don't have to be at war with each other, faith and science. And we can think about things in a reasonable way. My third thing to look out for is this idea that mechanism exhausts meaning. Now imagine that you came to my house tomorrow when I'm home and recovered a little from this weekend. And you came and I saw you walking up the road and you knocked on the door and I opened the door and I said, "Hello, it's great to see you. Enjoyed our chat yesterday. It's great to come in. Do come in." And then you walk into the kitchen and you see the kettle's boiling and you say to me, "Why is the water boiling?" Now, if I say to you, there's a heat source and water is going through a phase transition, it's boiling. The molecules are all speeding up because of the energy, and that's why the water is boiling. Now, you might say, okay, that's an interesting sort of answer. Not really the question I was asking. But it would be, in some ways, a way of answering the question, why is the water boiling? It does give a dimension of answer to it, or a level of meaning to it. But maybe you come into the house and you say, "Why is the water boiling?" And I say, "Well, I want a cup of tea. I saw you walking up the road. I thought you might want one too. Would you like a cup of tea?" That's also an answer to the question. But the important point here is that just because I've explained the mechanism of how the water is boiling doesn't mean I've exhausted the meaning of why the kettle is boiling. Both answers to the question, because I saw you and I want a cup of tea, and the water is going through a phase transition, that both of those are answers to the question, why is the water boiling? But they're just different levels of meaning, aren't they? And to think that explaining the mechanism of something, how something works, is to answer all the questions that can be answered about something, is to make a mistake, I put it to you. Now, sometimes science will explain this or that particular mechanism. Let's, for example, say that science explains the process by which you get human life, or by which the process you get a universe coming into being. That's exactly what science ought to be doing, isn't it? That's exactly what science should be doing. I don't want to say no to scientists who want to investigate that, and I think that's really praiseworthy. But it's impoverishing to think that just because you've explained the mechanism, you've explained the meaning of that. There can be layers of meaning to why there is human life and why there is a universe. And we know this from really concrete examples. It would be ridiculous to say that my wanting a cup of tea and seeing you walking up the road was not in any way relevant to the kettle boiling. It's very relevant to the kettle boiling. So I think science can describe many different things, many mechanisms, many structures, but mechanisms don't exhaust the meaning of some events, of some happenings, of some things. It can't get anywhere near some of the most important questions. For example, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What's the point of living? What is the purpose? And as a result, it just can't speak to some of our most basic and deepest needs. It can't offer us comfort in suffering. I don't know if you've ever tried to cuddle a chemistry textbook when you're going through suffering. It's not terribly comforting. It can't take away moral guilt. Big thing that we are searching for as human beings is a way to confront and deal with guilt and shame and evil in our own lives, I think, if we're honest. Can't deal with that. Science can't take that away. Can't deal with that. It can't transform a person out of bitterness into hope and life and love and grace. Science itself can't provide us with an integrating tapestry, an integrating picture, which science will fit into. Science is just a part of a worldview always. It's not itself a worldview. It's not itself a philosophy. Science is never on its own a way of looking at the world. It's only a mechanism by which we limit what we can study and then we do those repeatable experiments. It's not a worldview in itself. You've got to add something else to it. And so we need to look out for these three pitfalls, these three errors or mistakes. First of all, we shouldn't say it's faith or reason. We should say it's faith and reason. Secondly, we're looking out for zombies. Always good. Thirdly, we shouldn't think that explaining the mechanism of something completely exhausts the meaning of it. But then how should we approach these questions? And with the time I have left, I want to try to suggest a way of approaching that if you're thinking this through or helping other people think this through. Okay, so look at the screen. And could you just tell the person sitting next to you what the youngest age of the youngest person in that picture is? Just tell the person sitting next to you what the age of the youngest person in that picture is. Okay. So you might look at the waves, you might look at the trees, you might try to work out the species of tree. So you might look at the people, not going to move, and you might say, okay, I can do a calculation, but let me show you something else. That was always there. You see? Show you again? See the baby? There you go. Now, it's only, you could zoom in, couldn't you? And you could look at that detail. And that would give you some of the information that was there. But you can only answer the question I've actually posed by zooming out. You can only, by zooming out, see the whole picture. The evidence was right in front of us. It was there the whole time. It's the same picture I showed you first. Now, what science does is science gives us that detail. And Christians believe that the world is like that. We can understand so much, and science is so valuable because it gives us the detail. But there's also, if we zoom out, this bigger picture that God has put science in, has put us in, and it tells us about our significance and our meaning. And maybe if we step back, we might be able to come at these questions in a new way. Maybe less combative. Maybe a gentler way of coming at things. Now, some would say the burden of proof, the responsibility is on the person who claims that God exists. You believe in fairies at the bottom of the garden and Father Christmas and these sorts of things, then you have to prove that those things are real. You've got to give your evidence for God. You're claiming that God exists, and that somehow the default option is that God exists. Is that God doesn't exist, and that the person has to come and has to bring a proof. Now, I think that's an understandable reaction to an extent, but I think it's a mistaken one. it doesn't get us very far on either side of the fence to stay on either side of the fence just throwing rocks at each other. Is there another way of doing it? The great Cambridge physicist, a Christian, said this. John Polkinghorne said, if we want to understand the nature of reality, we have only two possible starting points, either the brute fact of the physical world or the brute fact of the divine will and the purpose behind that physical world. In other words, what he says is this, there's no view from nowhere. Nobody starts from zero. We're all in a perspective, we're all in a worldview, we're all starting from somewhere. And actually, one of the rational things we need to do is put on the jacket and look at it and say, actually, what makes the most sense? Does this make the most sense of the way the world is? Does this starting point resonate better? From this starting point, does what science can do resonate better? And does what questions the world throws at us resonate better? And does what Jesus claims to be and all of these other claims in the world, does that make more sense in this worldview or in that worldview, in that perspective? When I use the word worldview, I mean a perspective that we take on the world, a way of viewing the world that we're not always aware of. It's a bit like a pair of spectacles that we see the world through, and we're not really that aware of it all the time. We often catch it from other people or from culture, and we need to learn to sort of almost step back and to say, okay, I'm looking at it through this point of view, but maybe I need to be careful. Or maybe we say there's no God and look at the world and say, does the world make more sense if God isn't there? And my argument would be to you today and to your friends as you're talking to them about science and faith and to your family members would be that there's no burden of proof. There's no responsibility on either side to prove it or to disprove it. But actually, all of us have to calmly and honestly try to look at it, to take up each other's starting points and to try to see it from the other person's point of view and to see which makes the most rational sense. And I think this is this third way of, okay, weighing up the evidence, looking at things, being aware of where we're coming from. Science is not a worldview. It's not a perspective. It's not a philosophy in its own right. It's just a way of investigating something. You have to add it to something else to make it into a philosophy. So for me and for many Christians, believing in God is a natural home for science, because it explains why the world's uniform. It explains why our minds can understand the world. It explains why we feel like we want somebody to say thank you to. Why we find that there are moral truths in this world, like killing innocent children for fun. Why those things are wrong. And all of those things fit very naturally into a theistic, a worldview where God is in the center, where God's the author of that worldview. Because he supplies a standard of right and wrong. He supplies a standard of, and gives us minds which can think about the world. He creates a world that's orderly and is intelligible, that matches the way we think somehow. If you believe there's no God, then you've got to find other reasons for believing in uniformity, for believing in human rationality and human thinking can be safe and stable. You have to find other ways to explain moral truths. You have to find other ways to explain these sorts of things we experience. And you have to find other ways to explain Jesus as well. Okay, so I think I have a few moments to try to answer questions. But let me say this. Actually, no, I'm not sure I do. Let me just finish by saying this then. I could completely understand if the claim was there's a fairy at the bottom of the garden, then the onus would be on the person who makes a ridiculous claim. But when we deal with God, who claims to be the source of all being, I don't see that as similar to believing in fairies at the bottom of the garden. You know, sensible, rational Oxford professors are believing in this God, and they're not believing in fairies at the bottom of the garden. There's something else going on here. So look out for these false dilemmas, either science or stupid. Look out for the zombie, and look out for falling into the trap of thinking that it's mechanism exhausting meaning. And encourage other people, encourage yourself if you need encouragement, to look at it from these two different points of view and then to say which makes most sense of the way that we experience the world, the way that science works. Don't accept any pat answers. Don't accept any simplistic answers. And also, make sure the science that you're looking at is really good quality science as well. Make sure it's first-tier research science. And don't just settle for a a pat answer or a simple answer. Do that thing of really carefully thinking things through. My journey, thinking about questions in that sort of way, led me to Jesus, led me to Christ. And my prayer and hope is that that might happen to you if you haven't already, but it also might be an encouragement to you to point people towards him, that we don't have to get... The science isn't a barrier to believing in God. In fact, it enhances and points towards belief in God. Okay.